Hello, and welcome to Season 7, Episode 6 of Bad Gays, a podcast about evil and complicated queers in history. I'm Ben Miller, a writer, researcher, and member of the board of the Schwules Museum in Berlin.
And I'm Hugh Lemmy, a writer, author, and artist.
Last week, we talked about the conductor James Levine, who ran the Metropolitan Opera for more than 40 years and was also allegedly a serial workplace abuser and abuser of young men and boys. Who are we talking about this week, Hugh?
This week, we're going to talk about John Whitgift.
Who?
Ben, come on. I can't believe you don't know John Whitgift, a 15th century Archbishop of Canterbury.
Oh, of course, the 15th, yes, now that John Whitgift, right, okay. Is this my payback for making you listen to an hour about classical music last week?
Yeah.
You're going to make me think about the Church of England?
Exactly, this is the Reformation, this is my bag.
Oh, God.
But, well, it's funny you say that, because I do think people, especially people from outside of England, do like to think of my homeland as quite a sort of staid, formal, uptight even, dare I say it, place. But I think you can actually underestimate the country's capacity to be deeply weird.
Oh, I have never underestimated the capacity of England to be deeply weird, but
well, today we're going to get into,
some people do.
Today we're going to get into one of the sort of the weirdest, bloodiest, and maybe horniest moments of English history, which is the English Reformation. It was a time of enormous tumult and violence, but also of new ideas that reconfigured and really reshaped the entire world. And today's Bad Gay then is perhaps an unlikely and unfamiliar candidate to you, but it is one whose life and loves shed a light on that time. It's the theologian, reformer, and one-time Archbishop of Canterbury, John Whitgift. So let's start by talking about the Reformation. When we talk about the Reformation, we're really talking about this huge schism within the Western Christian Catholic Church that started around 1520 and lasted, it kind of depends on who you ask, but a good ending date would probably be around the Peace of Westphalia in 1648, although its repercussions and reverberations, of course, continue to today. So we're looking at a period of about 100 or 150 years where there's like a Europe-wide sort of popular theological movement which splits from the orthodoxy of the Catholic Church, which until then was dominant over the west of Europe and had successfully suppressed any of the major heretical movements that tried to reform or overturn it. So the church and various secular powers attempt to repress this movement, but it allies itself with other princes and secular powers until it establishes this new form of Christianity as something like a European counterpower, which itself becomes an establishment. And eventually it reaches a sort of truce based around much of Europe accepting a very limited degree of limited toleration, I guess, where people can just about practice their own religion without fear of death in countries of the other religion, although usually still with a good deal of persecution and disenfranchisement.
And when you say practice their own religion, you mean their particular flavor of Christianity, not actually their own religion, just to be clear.
Yeah, basically what I mean is that by the end of the Reformation, just about, you could practice being a Catholic in a Protestant country or vice versa without being killed, although quite often with serious restrictions on your sort of civil liberties and rights. And of course, Ben, as good loyal materialists and Marxists, we also must point out that the Reformation was not merely the result of this theological disagreement, but also of changes in the European economy and the power structures of the continent, which sort of used this opening caused by the Reformation to further their own interests, as economic interests do. So although there'd been like numerous religious movements aiming to change the church in the preceding centuries, the Reformation really began with a rebellious German monk called Martin Luther.
Heard of him.
He split from the Catholic Church on a basic theological principle, which is that grace, which is the salvation of God, was delivered on faith in Jesus alone. It wasn't reliant upon good works, doing good things. So this theological dispute builds on a political one, because for centuries the church had operated this system which was called indulgences, where you could reduce the time that you'd be punished for your sin and held in purgatory and get to heaven quicker were you to do a certain number of good deeds. And one of those good deeds just happened to be donating stuff to the church.
Oh, how convenient.
Yeah. So many Christians had come to see this, understandably, as a form of sort of legitimized corruption. And in its wake, they began to question all sorts of the elements of the church hierarchy and teaching.
So this is how, if you're, you know, a Medici or something, you can essentially buy your right to do all sorts of naughty things and be reassured that at the end you're, you know, still on the way to heaven.
Yeah, they developed the church had developed this idea of purgatory, which doesn't exist within scripture at all, but it's this sort of holding cell where you have to do your time before you can choose. And in giving indulgences and buying indulgences, you could actually reduce the amount of time you get to heaven, as well as saying prayers for the dead and paying monks to pray for you and things like this. There were
carbon offsets for the soul.
Yeah, exactly, like carbon offsets for the soul. There were also some other very important beliefs that drove the early reformers to split from the Catholic Church, like, for example, the idea of sola scriptura, which is something the religious nonconformists have been talking about actually for centuries beforehand. But that's this idea that the teachings necessary for salvation were all to be found in the Bible, and anything that wasn't found in the Bible wasn't strictly necessary. And other important issues for reformers, again, for centuries before the Reformation really got going, was that of whether infants should be baptized or whether it's something you should willingly and consciously choose to do as an adult, and also issues around whether the Bible should be translated and available to the lay reader or should be reserved for the priest class who can speak Latin.
So basically there's two main, as I understand it, and tell me if I'm wrong here, two main clusters of things that spark the birth of Protestantism. One being the theological disagreement, which is that Protestants are emphasizing a much more direct and individual relationship with the divine,
mm-hmm.
right? You don't need this sort of mediating priest class of texts and interpreters in Latin and et cetera, ritual. And the second one then being the idea that with all of this kind of all of these bureaucratic layers between you and the divine had grown moldy and corrupt, and, you know, you have popes having illegitimate children. And yeah, I think there was one episode, or was it in the book, Hugh, where we told the story that Martin Luther said the Pope had been fucked to death?
Yeah.
Which, you know, I think we said at the time that we weren't sure how firm a grasp Luther had on the mechanics of anal, but that it did give a sense of the degree to which people perceived the church as being really sort of moldy and corrupt
not in touch with the true teachings of Christ, really. And that these two issues of the sort of corruption and also the theological developments and sort of go hand in hand. They encouraged each other. And also, I think the spirit of sort of questioning the authority and teachings of the church had really been fueled at that time by the growth of humanism in Europe. So humanism was this intellectual movement that was spreading through Europe, through the cultural centers, really, which tried to sort of look again at the core texts that had made European culture. And that was sort of encouraged by these two big developments, one of which was the scholars bringing Christian and classical texts to Europe following mm-hmm. the defeat of the Byzantines by the Ottomans. The Byzantines, of course, being Christian, but Eastern Christian. And the development of the printing press, which increased access to these texts of all kinds. So this led, of course, to the retranslation of the Bible, correcting earlier mistakes in the Bible, which undermined further the authority of the church. And also humanist thinkers and writers like Erasmus, for example, who advocated like reform, but not really reformation. They were Catholic, but they wanted to reform the church. But nonetheless, they were still highly influential on reformation thinkers like Luther, and they advocated engagement and access to religious texts, and they opposed what they called superstition. And the Reformation wasn't sort of one organizational movement. The Reformation happened in different ways and at different times across Europe. So Luther, of course, started the German Reformation in 1517 when he nailed his 95 theses, which were really these sort of discussion points and complaints, to the church door in Wittenberg, which is where he was a professor of moral theology.
And I will tell you, having lived in Germany now for 7 years, that people do be nailing 95 point list to your door if they think that you have not behaved very well.
Are you playing your music too loud?
Exactly.
And then the Reformation in Switzerland kicked off 5 years later with this pastor called Huldrych Zwingli, who was a really fascinating character. He was deeply influenced by Luther, but Zwingli went to a dinner in Zurich at a friend's house during Lent, and his friend was this printer, and he'd supposedly invited all the workers at his print shop over after they'd finished printing this new edition of the Epistles of Paul. And of course, during Lent, the Catholic Church totally forbade anyone from eating meat as part of this thing called the Lenten fast. But that isn't actually derived at all from any verse in scripture. And so following this principle of sola scriptura, that only the Bible truly dictated the path to salvation, this printer served sausages. So this scandal of serving sausages for dinner kicked off Zwingli's career. It was a huge scandal. And he sort of took it on as a reformer and iconoclast who was even more radical than Luther.
Once again, having lived in Germany for 7 years, I will say that serving sausages is considered this important culturally and socially.
But in England, however, the Reformation was kicked off with an even bigger sausage fest, which is the love life of Henry VIII.
Right. So in England, was there at all a popular Reformation movement before Henry VIII, or was it just that Henry VIII decided he wanted a divorce?
I'll get into this, but yeah, there was this movement that came before Luther, ended 50 years even before Luther. That had gone for a 100 years or something like this, which was the Lollards. But because it didn't go anywhere, they're not really remembered. They weren't thought of as reformers, they were thought of as heretics. But there was a movement, and that was involved in a lot of similar issues, especially around like printing the Bible. So this is when it gets like very interesting and weird. So, as we've seen, the Reformation in Europe had largely been a dispute based in theology, and theologians like Luther and Zwingli had to make these sort of alliances and find common ground with secular powers in order to sort of survive and spread their message. But in England, it was the other way around. There were Protestants in England. William Tyndale had printed an edition of most of the Bible in 1525, which is around this time this is all kicking off in the rest of Europe. And he was then strangled and then burnt at the stake in the Netherlands for this heresy, like a decade later.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's a very brutal era. And in 1530, which was the year that our bad gay John Whitgift was born, the first Protestant martyr was executed in England. So this was just a decade or so after the last execution of the English medieval heretics, the Lollards. So yeah, there's a 10-year gap almost between one and the other. You see again this idea that the Reformation was like a rearticulation of theological debates that had been going on within the Catholic Church for centuries. And the English Protestants like Tyndale had emerged out of this sort of heretical Lollardian movements. So the English Reformation's tendency towards iconoclasm, the destruction of religious images, probably owes as much to the Lollards as it does to sort of the influence of continental iconoclasts like Zwingli. So at the time of Whitgift's birth, we have this very pretty small Protestant movement in England that has been repressed by a very loyal Catholic king, Henry VIII. In fact, Henry VIII was so loyal that he the Pope actually bestowed upon him the title Defender of the Faith as a reward for a book that he'd written specifically attacking Luther. A book which has probably been or possibly been co-authored by Erasmus's best friend, the English Catholic humanist, intellectual, politician, author, etc., Thomas More. Or perhaps actually by a Catholic bishop called John Fisher, both of whom would later be executed by Henry. But no, Henry was not a Protestant reformer and a radical Protestant reformer in any way. He was motivated, let's say, by more earthly desires, which are sex and reproduction. Because Henry VIII was never meant to have been the king. He's kind of like the equivalent of Prince Harry today. His elder brother, Arthur, had been the heir to the throne, and Henry had been the spare. But at the age of 11, their father, Henry VII, had married Arthur off to Catherine of Aragon, who was the daughter of the King and Queen of Spain, in order to form this alliance with Spain. But a few years later, they contracted this mysterious sweating sickness where they couldn't stop sweating. And Arthur died from it, but Catherine of Aragon survived. So
are you telling me that if not for a puddle of sweat, Arthur might have become King of England, married to the extremely Catholic Catherine of Aragon, and there may not have been an English Reformation?
Absolutely that. There may well not have been English Reformation at all. England might have remained a Catholic country.
We would have been spared so many Church of England teas. That is what the Church of England mostly does, right? Tea?
Pretty much, yeah.
Socials?
Well, no.
I remember once, because in the U.S. they're called Episcopalians, uh-huh. And my grandmother's Italian Catholic, and I remember driving once past an Episcopalian church with my grandmother as a child, and I said, you know, what's different? Like, what do they do? And she sort of thought for a minute, and she said, well, they sing more and they don't have the Pope and they have lunch.
They do other pretty terrible things, actually, as we'll discover. But this marriage between Arthur and Catherine wasn't consummated. And because they wanted to assure this alliance, she was then married off to her husband's younger brother, Prince Henry, who would become Henry VIII.
Oh, great. She must have been thrilled.
Yeah, but marrying your brother's wife was unfortunately illegal under church, what I call canon law. But the Pope gave a special dispensation to the couple, as Catherine swore that her marriage to Arthur had never been consummated, and so this first marriage was annulled and she was allowed to marry Henry. Now, fast forward some 20 years later, Catherine has still not produced a surviving male heir for Henry. She suffered 5 miscarriages or stillborn births.
Oh, that's awful.
Yeah. And she gave birth to one surviving son who was called Henry, who survived for just 52 days. And her only child who survived to adulthood was a daughter called Mary. So Henry was desperate for a son. And coincidentally, his eye had been caught by this pretty young thing flitting around court, a lady in waiting to the Queen called Anne Boleyn. But Anne wasn't stupid. Henry had already been fucking her sister, Mary, and Anne didn't want to end up like her sister, like possibly bearing him illegitimate children. So she held out for marriage. So Henry went back to the church and he said, "My marriage has been blighted and I've been cursed to produce no male heir because I've committed the sin of marrying my brother's wife." So suddenly, after 20 years, he'd been gripped by these pangs of conscience at having broken canon law.
Oh, yes, I'm sure that's how he had to do it.
And not because he wanted to shut up his girlfriend's hot younger sister. And so he begged the Pope to have the marriage annulled, but the law was very clear. Like, because he'd received a special dispensation to marry poor Catherine, he now couldn't have it annulled.
Right.
So angry as a result, Henry moved against the Catholic Archbishop of Canterbury, a guy called Cardinal Thomas Wolsey, or Second Thomas of the story, whom he regarded as sort of having dragged his feet at best over the affair, and sort of, yeah, not helped him. So he seized his property and he stripped him of his political role as Lord High Chancellor, and he demanded he come to London for trial for having put the authority of the Pope above that of the King. And that's a charge that would probably have led to his execution. But luckily for Thomas Wolsey, he died en route of natural causes. But luckily for Henry, this allowed him to begin his break with Rome. So he replaced Wolsey as the Lord High Chancellor with his old ally, another Thomas called Thomas More. That's the first Thomas.
Right. Who, I remember Thomas More.
Who potentially co-authored this polemic against Luther.
Right, who also wrote Utopia and sort of famed...
Absolutely.
...social and political and theological theorist.
Yeah. So More did want reform, but he wanted it within the Catholic Church, and he wanted also power to suppress the heretical Protestant movements. But there was a third Thomas on the scene called Thomas Cromwell, who people who've read Wolfhall will know that's the main character in the book by Hilary Mantel. So Cromwell saw what a lot of princes in Europe who had put their political weight behind Luther also saw, that embracing the Reformation provided ample opportunities for the secular state to wrest power from the ecclesiastical power of the church, which had dominated Europe as this idea of Christendom for the past 1,000 years right. or so.
Will no one rid me of this meddlesome pope?
All right. So within the medieval period, Western Europe was kind of regarded as a single polity, although there were many countries and kingdoms and principalities and so on, and they were often at war with one another as competing secular rivals. They were also held together within this wider political organization, let's say, of the Catholic Church, which had its own law, which was canon law, and its right. own rule, which was the papacy.
Right, and you were supposed to kind of recognize papal authority over certain things, and you're supposed to think of yourselves as kind of part of this big... People,
yeah, and really. the Pope was a political actor who could make deals and placate people and negotiate peace or war.
Right, so you had this other king who was competing with you. Yeah, the king of the church,
who was competing but not really competing. He was kind of above in some ways.
Right. Well, unless you were in Italy, in which case.
Well, yeah, but this is a very broad brush painting of the idea of Christendom and as a polity, which obviously evolved a huge amount and was subject to a lot of conflicts and pressures over the years. But it's this basic vision of the European polity before the Reformation. So the Reformation offered the possibility of other political entities, that is, like states, that were not subject to this overarching authority of the Pope. And that was very appealing to Henry VIII because it was very unlikely that the Pope was going to budge on this issue of his remarriage.
Right.
Because the Pope was very scared of the Holy Roman Emperor, who was called Charles V, at the time, because his troops had happened recently to have taken him hostage and to have trashed Rome for their own reasons. So Charles V...
Very holy and very Roman, that empire.
And so Charles V had an aunt, and his aunt was Catherine of Aragon.
Oh!
So the Pope was not going to side with Henry and annoy this very powerful emperor by granting Henry this divorce from his aunt.
Right. And also, it seems to be a very, very open and shut case of canon law here. And, like, given the fact that he already had a special dispensation to marry this woman in the first place, getting a second special dispensation on the same marriage is, you know, to require one special dispensation from the Pope regarding a marriage can be regarded as misfortune, but to require two special dispensations from the Pope begins to look like carelessness.
Absolutely, yeah. And at the same time, of course, Henry had lots of reasons why he'd like to be outside the Pope's authority in a Catholic church, namely that he gets to fuck Anne Boleyn.
Right.
So Thomas Cromwell, this lawyer, and he's an MP and this close advisor to the king, he helps push through Parliament a series of reforms within English law, which bit by bit seized powers from the Pope and gave them to the crown. And this is a hugely significant moment in European history, in some ways leading to the creation of the modern concept of the state as a secular power. It was an attack on the clergy. It removed their privileges that had allowed them, you know, for example, to be tried only by religious courts. And now it made the clergy subject to secular law. So the state became now more important than the church. And he forced the clergy to acknowledge him as the supreme head of the Church of England and not the Pope. So this is the start of the development of the Church of England. And he also banned the right of legal appeal outside of the kingdom. So you couldn't take your complaints. If you were unhappy with what the king was doing, you couldn't take your complaints to the Pope. The crown became the supreme source of justice. Taxes on ecclesiastical incomes became payable to the crown and not to the Pope. And then in 1536, Thomas Cromwell achieved his biggest goal, which was persuading Parliament to begin the dissolution of the monasteries. And this involved the seizure of huge tracts of land and property that were owned by the church and made it the property of the king or his nobles.
Right. And this was also accompanied by a lot of rumors, right, about the monasteries being sites of sodomy and et cetera. Yeah,
yeah, and we'll get to that in a bit.
Okay.
But more importantly, it sort of effectively dissolved the social and political power of the Catholic Church in England and Wales and destroyed its role within communities. It also had massive economic implications, of course, and much of the land that had previously been owned by the church was enclosed. And tithes and various taxes and payments made by those people living on the land became payable not to the religious but to secular authorities. So in short, it helped in the creation and development of a very powerful gentry and also paved the way for the growth of a bourgeois class. What we're seeing here is that the Reformation in England, in all the rest of Europe, wasn't based in theological argument.
At all.
Not really, and not really in popular discontent with the corruption of the Catholic Church. Like, the Catholic Church in England was regarded as a European success story. That's where it was most popular, which is unusual. Instead, the Reformation really came from these political and economic concerns, and it was achieved through tying the church closer to the state, not making it further from it, and it's sort of increasing the worldly corruption of it in some ways.
But in fact, if there's corruption, it's Henry VIII.
Exactly. So theologically speaking, the Anglican Church is actually much more similar to the Catholic Church than many other Protestant denominations. You know, like the Anglican Church has priests, and they believe in the Trinity, and they practice infant baptism, and they practice apostolic succession, which means they have bishops and stuff like this. But the Church of England is deeply, deeply integrated into the state of England still, under the time.
Right. I mean, they just have the king or queen as pope now.
Yeah. And it's all under this idea of the crowns. England has a state religion. The British monarch is crowned in a religious ceremony. That's what makes them the king. The top bishops of the country automatically sit unelected in the legislature, deciding on the laws of the country. There's nothing you can do to stop it. If someone becomes a bishop because the Archbishop of Canterbury has chosen to become a bishop, then they sit in the House of Lords and they can rule on laws. So Britain is technically a theocratic state. It's one of the only countries in the world, I think Iran is one of the others, that has its priest class sitting in the legislature as a matter of course.
Wow.
So there's two really interesting points on here. One, and this is interesting to me, and it's just my opinion, but it's how this process has actually changed the Church of England into one of the sort of most intellectually, morally, and definitely spiritually moribund religions in the history of the world. The dissolution of the monasteries very nearly destroyed entirely any culture of sort of contemplative and mystical spiritual practice in England at all, from which, you know, this meaningful engagement of the sorrows of the world comes, which are traditionally through monasteries and interpersonal relationships with the divine. So the Anglican Church in England is so deeply tied to temporal power and politics. It makes it absolutely hopeless at having any sort of moral position that is contrary to that of the establishment. This runs throughout its history. So, for example, the Church of England, this is fascinating, and I think most people, I think a lot of people in England don't know this. The Church of England actually ran its own slave plantations. It wasn't investing in other people's slave plantations, which is bad enough. It had its own slave plantation, the Codrington plantations in Barbados, which had a board of trustees, and the Archbishop of Canterbury was the top of the board of trustees.
Oh, my God.
So that's the sort of like religious position it takes. And actually, it set up its own printing, published its own books, own versions of the Bible, in which they took out Exodus and any mention of freedom and slavery in order to distribute them to their own slaves that they owned.
Jesus Christ. Yeah. Evil, evil, evil.
Yeah. And it runs really right up to the modern date. You know, recently, Anglicans in Gaza have been particularly appalled by the contemporary Archbishop of Canterbury's sort of equivocation over a genocide of Palestinians, and have been speaking out about that because he's not really in a position to because of its tie with the state. And this contemplative Christian tradition, which is kind of one of my interests, that only really reemerged later, I think, in these Protestant sects who then dissented later from the Church of England still further. And we've got some really good names coming up because it's interesting how the sects that practice the contemplative tradition, which are groups like the Ranters, the Quakers, the Diggers, the Muggletonians, a good one. They were extremely overrepresented in the radical movements that sort of were pushing for populist political sovereignty and suffrage during the English Civil War a century later. And also trade unionism and socialism, they sort of took root not in the Church of England, but in the Methodist tradition.
Well, how could they take root in the Church of England? The Church of England is, like, at its core, a particular state power religion. I mean, it would be like radical socialism trying to take off in Catholic Rome in the 19th century.
But yeah.
That doesn't happen.
Yeah. I mean, there's a saying in England, which is the Church of England is the Tory party at prayer, which I think is about right. But secondly, and more importantly for our listeners, I think, is the relationship between English Reformation and then attitudes towards same-sex desire. Because sex wasn't just a causal factor for the Reformation in England. It was like partly also the tool that they used, because in the same year that Henry's Reformation Parliament had passed the Suppression of the Clergy Act, it also introduced the Buggery Act, which was the first time that sodomy had been made a criminal offence in England. And that's really important for two reasons. Firstly, because it's a clear-as-day power grab by Henry of taking sort of sexual offences from the remit of canon law and bring it into secular law.
Yeah.
And secondly, it's important because it's a tool for oppressing the clergy. So Cromwell then used this law, and also widespread suspicion amongst the public that convents and monasteries were hotbeds of sexual immorality.
Well, I mean, I remember I've been at a Carlini episode, don't you?
Well, yeah. So he used that as an excuse to make inspections of the monasteries. And then, so in 1535, he ordered agents to visit hundreds and hundreds of these monasteries. And he produced these scandalous documents that are known as the Disclosures, which were read to an appalled parliament. And according to Louis...
They were just appalled as they kept their hands just under the desk.
Yeah. So according to the historian Louis Crompton, in 175 entries in these disclosures, there were 180 monks that were described as sodomites. So as always, when we're talking about this, there's a note of caution, because prior to the Reformation, both sodomy and buggery could refer not just to same-sex activity, but to any sort of sexual activity that was non-productive, including between men and women. Still, it's fair to assume, given the way that the law would become the main tool for the suppression of same-sex activity over the next 350 years, that it was understood to include sodomy as same-sex activity. And some entries are explicit. And one provision under the law that was very helpful to Henry was that those who were convicted under it could have their property seized by the Crown.
Oh, how wonderfully convenient that one is. Yeah. That's just great.
And so Henry actually used this law explicitly to persecute his opponents. And the first person to be executed under the Buggery Act was Lord Hungerford, whom he had suspected of treason, whose own religious advisor had been part of this thing called the Pilgrimage of Grace, which was like a popular uprising against the dissolution of the monasteries in the north of England. So he was beheaded in 1540 at the Tower of London, the same day that Henry VIII's fifth wedding to Catherine Howard, and the same day as the execution of that old rogue who'd orchestrated this whole damn thing in the first place and had now fallen from the king's favour, Thomas Cromwell. So all these Thomases all end up getting in a chop, really.
You know, Hugh, now that we're moving on from Boylan, this is the time when I do my usual chime in to let you know that there is actually, this made it to the world of opera. There is a mid-19th century Donizetti opera called Anna Bolena, which documents the life of Anna and her rival, Giovanna di Seymour.
Giovanna di Seymour.
And it ends with Anna singing Copia Iniqua and being dragged off to the gallows in a chirpy D major.
Okay, but we're halfway into this episode and we still haven't even touched on our bad guy, John Whitgift, really. But I thought we had to sort of understand the English Reformation in brief, because it really was the entire story of Whitgift's life. John Whitgift was born right at the start of this period of tumult in 1530, or around 1530, in Grimsby, which is this little Lincolnshire fishing and trading town. And his father, Henry Whitgift, was a merchant who was doing very well for himself and was very prominent in town politics. His uncle, Robert Whitgift, was the abbot of the nearby Augustinian monastery of Wellow Abbey. So, a strong Catholic. And he saw promise in his brother's eldest son. So he persuaded Henry to send John to school in London. And he stayed there with his aunt Isabel, whose husband was the verger, which is kind of caretaker, at St. Paul's Cathedral, London's cathedral. And so he was studying at St. Anthony's School, and he got thrown out by his aunt because she, quote, perceived him to be the devil because he was refusing to attend Catholic Mass. So from an early age, he seemed to be very involved in and influenced by the changes that were taking place in the Reformation. And those changes were really only just starting to get up steam. So in 1547, Henry VIII died, and his son, the 9-year-old Edward VII, took to the throne ahead of his half-sisters, Mary, who was the daughter of Catherine of Aragon, and Elizabeth, the daughter of Anna Bolena.
Yes. There's also there ended up being three Tudor Queen operas by Donizetti, and it's kind of a coloratura soprano hat trick to do all three. Anna Bolena, Maria Stuarda, and the third one is called Roberta Devereux, after Elizabeth's lover, but you do sing the role of Elisabetta, so you know.
So after the death of Henry VIII, John started university in Cambridge, firstly at Queen's College and then at Pembroke. And his tutor was this reformer, and he was chaplain to King Edward, who was called John Bradford. And he was the president of Pembroke at the time, was the Archbishop of Canterbury. So he was right in the heart of that debate. And he was surrounded by these reformers, and he was studying divinity in this very febrile atmosphere of theology. And he largely kept himself out of trouble and out of the limelight, just progressing slowly through university, which was a very useful and impressive skill during the Reformation.
Yeah, because this is a time when, there's fears that the whole thing is going to become Catholic again, right?
Right, and he's the nephew of this bishop, but Henry VIII had instigated the Reformation, but it didn't really actually get going until the reign of this child king, Edward, because he had these very powerful advisors who were advocating for Reformation. So here we introduce our fourth Thomas and yet another Archbishop of Canterbury, Thomas Cranmer. So Cranmer had been Archbishop of Canterbury since 1533, like very early in the Reformation in England, and he was himself a reformer. But despite the political and economic advantage that Henry had taken, actual theological reform had been quite mild, especially compared to the Lutheran reforms on the continent.
Right.
Reformation that's driven by politics, not principle, had meant that Henry had gone back and forth between these different factions, and he'd passed this thing called the Six Acts that protected traditional Catholic principles like clerical celibacy and transubstantiation. But under Edward, Cranmer really got going. So just 6 months after the death of Henry, Cranmer ordered new inspections of England's churches. He began implementing major restrictions on Catholic traditions that were seen to be superstitious. The rosary was banned. Processions, which had been obviously a big part of public everyday life, were banned. Votive candles and holy water and all that jazz was all attacked.
They banned all the good stuff.
Yeah. Purgatory out. Chantry services, chapels, that's places you go to pray for the souls of the dead, sold off. A new mass was introduced. Confession became optional. And the Eucharist was reformed with this a sacrament, but it no longer meant it was the actual blood and flesh of Christ, but it became the symbolic blood and flesh of Christ, which was a victory for metaphor everywhere. Also for the priests, because it meant they could then take any leftover wine home, because it wasn't actually the blood of Christ anymore. And the liturgical year was reformed, so almost all the holidays and saints' days were removed except from Christmas, Easter and Whitsun. So again, the Anglican Church removing all the worthwhile bits to produce the most bureaucratic and joyless religion they possibly could.
Right.
And Cranmer also introduced two books of Common Prayer, the second editing out any part of the first that was still usable by Catholics, which dictated how the liturgy in the Church of England should be conducted. And finally, Cranmer introduced a new law, a very important one, called the Act of Uniformity, which meant jail time for anyone who was conducting a liturgy other than the one laid out in his Book of Common Prayer, which included life imprisonment for the third offence. So this was an attempt to finally concretize what the Church of England really meant and believed. It was a sort of, in the end, it believed in a sort of milquetoast Calvinism.
Yeah, it meant nothing and believed in power.
Yeah. The basic theology of it is like a very weak Calvinism. And it was probably the most Protestant that it actually got during that period. It was a sort of a radical 6 years for the church, which ended when Edward died in 1553, aged just 15. And in his will, he had nominated a distant, but more importantly, Protestant cousin of his called Lady Jane Grey to be the queen. But after only 9 days, the support for his half-sister, Mary, overwhelmed the process. Mary became queen and kills Lady Jane Grey. Being the daughter of Catherine of Aragon, Mary was, of course, Catholic, and she began a restoration of the Catholic Church in England, and she has this reputation as a very brutal reactionary. She's sometimes remembered in England by the nickname Bloody Mary, but this is really a simplification. Her early reign starts with some attempt at a kind of reconciliation, keeping some of the reforms that Cranmer had brought in while reconciling the country and the Church of Rome. And you have to remember that the Catholic Church had been pretty successful and popular prior to Henry VIII, and so Protestants were still in the minority at this point. But this conciliatory attitude curdled. Cranmer was stripped of being archbishop, and he was tried for sedition, and he was eventually burnt at the stake as a heretic, along with hundreds of other Protestants, sort of reformers and such like. But Whitgift very cleverly managed to navigate through her reign, which for him was mercifully just 5 years long. And she was replaced by her half-sister Elizabeth. So Elizabeth took a chance to break from Rome and reinstate a Protestant liturgy in the Church of England. And while she was a Protestant, she was still very much conservative in religious matters. She inaugurated what's known as the Elizabethan Settlement, which introduced some aspects again that were familiar to Catholic worshippers into the church, and created greater space for both Catholics and Lutherans to follow some of their beliefs while still outwardly conforming to the Church of England.
Now, do we know why Elizabeth settled on Protestantism? Did it come from personal conviction? Did it come from the idea that this was just the best thing to do at the time because that's where the balance of forces lay?
Well, she was raised a Protestant. Her father had already...
So it was conviction?
Yeah. It was conviction. She did have a strong Protestant conviction, but it was quite conservative. It was towards what today you'd probably call something like the High Church, which was like the Catholic-leaning end of the Church of England. But she was not into Catholicism as much for political reasons, and she suppressed Catholic worship, and then she'd go on to persecute and execute many priests as her reign continued. But at the same time, she sort of slowed and eventually stalled the Reformation in general in England by refusing the demands of the Calvinists to go any further and to produce the sort of forms of worship that you are familiar with in Northern European Protestant countries. It's not a Lutheran or Calvinist church in that way. So her compromise seemed to sort of hold, and gradually the influence of the Catholic Church and its ability, importantly, to recruit and retain new believers waned. So Whitgift's career at this point was sort of in the ascendancy. In 1660, just a few years into her reign, he took religious vows. He rose to prominence both at Cambridge University and in the church, and he became the vice-chancellor and Regius Professor of Divinity at Cambridge. But also he was the Bishop of Worcester, so these twin roles brought him this political power and also great wealth. And as bishop, it was actually, interestingly, Whitgift who signed Shakespeare and Anne Hathaway's marriage license.
Oh, wow.
As he gains power, you start to see him use it not actually to suppress Catholics, but actually fellow Protestants whose ideas he opposed. His real enemy were Puritans, those within the Church of England who wanted to take the Reformation further and take their new church in a more Calvinist direction. He was a Calvinist, but he suppressed it to take these sort of roles within the church. He was a careerist.
Right, and such a careerist that he ended up actually persecuting other Calvinists.
Yeah, who are too Calvinist for him.
Too Calvinist for him.
Yeah, yeah. That's his gift, if you like. That it sort of mirrors that of the history of Anglicanism. That you limit reform to remain as close and loyal to the sort of temporal hierarchies as you can. And in 1670, for example, he forced the Puritan Thomas Cartwright, who was a fellow professor at Cambridge, firstly from his job, and then he forced him from his fellowship for advocating for this Presbyterianism, which is a church without bishops. So at Cambridge, John began to grow, let's say, some close interpersonal relationships with men. Interestingly, he taught...
This has never happened since.
Gay men at Cambridge. Shocking. No. He taught both Francis Bacon and Anthony Bacon, these brothers, not Francis Bacon the painter, but Francis Bacon the statesman and philosopher. And his brother, Anthony, was a spy, Elizabethan spy, and they were both... bad gays in our own rights. We could do a whole Bacon series, to be honest.
Yeah, the other Francis Bacon.
Yeah, the other Francis Bacon. But his closest relationship, which he began while he was at Cambridge, was with his tutor and fellow theologian, a guy called Dr. Andrew Perne. Perne was a remarkable figure for all the wrong reasons. He appears to be a man entirely without a backbone. He once donated a weather vane to St. Peter's Church in Cambridge, which is still there, which bears his initials, AP, and parishioners at the church joked that it stood for a Papist, a Protestant, a Puritan, depending on which way the wind was blowing.
Ha ha ha.
He went from Catholic to Protestant to Catholic to Protestant again. Every time the state religion switched, with each monarch, he changed. So when Mary had the corpses of two Protestant reformers dug up so that they could then be tried and burnt for heresy, he preached at their disinterment. But then 3 years later, when they were rehabilitated under the reign of Elizabeth, he preached at the proceedings for their rehabilitation as well. In the same church.
Smart man. If you can pull it off. He's a completely straight face.
Turns out I was wrong 3 years ago when I said these corpses should be burnt. Anyway, the true nature of his relationship with...
I'm so easily assimilated.
the nature of his relationship with John is impossible really to determine, because if anything happened, you know, they were never tried, never upon trial for it. So, and they never wrote about it themselves, obviously, so we can't know. But there is a lot of evidence from other people at the time. But it is clear that their bond was deep and lifelong and seemingly inexplicably close. They went in to help each other when it didn't make sense. So at first, Dr. Perne, who was 11 years John's senior, was his tutor. But his care towards Whitgift was clearly... let's say more than pedagogical. According to Whitgift's biography, while he was a fellow at Cambridge, John fell grievously sick and was, by commandment of Dr. Perne, who much tendered him in regard of his good parts, carried to a house near the college, whither Dr. Perne came often to visit him, and willed the woman of the house that he should want nothing, neither should she spare any cost for his good and the recovery of his health, saying that if he lived he would be able to pay to defray the charge himself, but if he died, the said Dr. Perne would satisfy her and pay for all things.
Well, when the good parts are good, then it's worth any price.
And well tended to.
And well tended to, exactly.
Whitgift actually considered sort of exile from England during the reign of Mary, but Dr. Perne said he should stay and, quote, talked with him and found him resolute in his religion, yielding, as Dr. Perne often acknowledged afterwards, many good and sound reasons therefore. Whereupon the doctor willed him to be silent and not troublesome in uttering his opinion, whereby others may take occasion to call him into question. And he, for his part, would wink at him, and so order the matter that he might continue his religion and not travel out of the university, which accordingly the good old man justly performed, for which his favour the archbishop carried a loving, faithful, and true heart towards him unto his dying day. So he's basically saying, look, don't leave, because that'll be obvious that you're a Protestant. Just keep your head down, shut up, don't say anything, don't raise any questions.
Company man.
Yeah. And the attitude of keeping his head down and, like Perne, hitching his wagon to the service of authority and power served him extremely well. And then in 1583, Queen Elizabeth made him the Archbishop of Canterbury, which is the most powerful.
There you go, it works.
Yeah, it's the most powerful figure in the church below the monarch. So Elizabeth had seen him preach, and she had admired his very conservative Anglican approach in his sermons, even though he was a Calvinist. And furthermore, he was clearly very loyal to the idea of bonding ecclesiastical and state power. He became a trusted advisor to her, and she referred to him as, quote, my little black husband, which was a reference to his stature, but also his dress. But I think also it's quite a telling reference, because they have this shared bond of wedding the church and the crown ever closer. But it wasn't a very popular choice. One man in government said, quote, the choice of that man to be archbishop maketh me to think that the Lord is even determined to scourge his church for their unthankfulness.
Yeah.
So taking this role, he moved his very special friend, Dr. Pern, into his new digs, which is Lambeth Palace, where the Archbishop lives, which is just across the Thames from Westminster. 2 years later, in 1585, the Queen made him a Privy Councillor. The Privy Council is this very powerful and, of course, unelected body of sort of politicians and clergy, nobles, judges, soldiers, that advises the monarch about what they can and can't and should and shouldn't do in the exercise of their power. In Britain's unwritten constitution, they serve to facilitate this relationship between the state itself, which is embodied in the crown, and parliament, among other things. And it was under Elizabeth that this institution really started to take its modern form. So through the Privy Council, the monarch could issue edicts and grant charters. Whitgift was now enormously powerful, the most powerful churchman in England, and he began wielding that power to suppress his Puritan enemies, whom he regarded not just as personal and theological enemies, but more importantly, enemies of the crown. In 1586, the political court, the Star Chamber, issued an edict putting him in charge of the control and licensing of the country's printing presses, which allowed him to leverage his huge power to attack those who criticised him or his plans in print. And a few years later, this allowed him to act very brutally during the Emir Prelate controversy, which was when a series of these very bawdy satirical pamphlets written under this pseudonym, Martin Mar Prelate, were released. And these pamphlets really poked fun at the Anglican Church, the clergy and the hierarchy, but from a Puritan position. Which is funny, because when you think of the Puritans today, we tend to have this stereotype of them as like very joyless, let's cancel Christmas, starch-collared sort of boring people, but they were writing these quite ribald, like naughty pamphlets, let's say, and these bawdy satires. And it was a theological movement first and foremost. Anyway, Whitgift, who the author of the pamphlet calls, quote, that miserable and desperate caitiff, wicked John Whitgift, the Pope of Lambeth. He comes under attack particularly, and in very fruity language, saying, quote, he, I pray you, that was sometimes Dr. Pern's boy, and carried his cloak bag after him, believe me, he hath leapt lustily.
Oh.
I think even today, if you're particularly close to your tutor at university and someone accused you of being his boy and carrying his cloak bag after him, I think everyone will know what they're getting at.
Yeah, tenderness in good parts once again.
Whitgift never actually managed to identify the authors of this pamphlet. Now we think that it was probably written by this guy with the wonderfully named Puritan Job Throckmorton.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah. But the printer was a Welshman called John Penry who ran this illicit printing press, and he was forced onto the run. And eventually, nine Puritans, including Whitgift's old enemy, Thomas Cartwright, who he'd thrown out of the university, they were caught and brought to trial, and they were only released when they promised that they'd renounce their Presbyterian beliefs. So some Puritans were starting to believe that attempts to push the Reformation further within the Church of England were futile. It was only by breaking from the Church they could build a new form of worship and especially of organization of the Church that was acceptable to God. And one of these groups were called the Brownists, after their founder, a guy called Robert Brown. So Brown was this Church of England priest who had he was actually the first one to secede from the church and to start his own church. And so his followers, the Brownists, were bitterly persecuted for breaking from the church. Brown actually returned to the church, but his followers continued to plow in their own furrow. And among their members was John Penry, the printer. And he'd returned to London, and he was recognised, and on some sort of trumped up charge of sedition that was laid against him, although clearly his crime was insulting Whitgift. And so he was caught and tried and hanged on the Old Kent Road, leaving his widow and his four daughters, who had, again, the splendidly puritanical names of Deliverance, Comfort, Safety, and Sure Hope.
Deliverance, Comfort, Safety, and Sure Hope.
English Puritan names from the 16th and 17th century are really, really amazing.
These are all such good drag names.
Because they were moving away from this idea of Catholic names, you know, like Michael and John or whatever, and they were inventing ones based around beliefs, I guess, yeah.
Oh. I saw Goody Proctor dancing with the devil.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, it's a really interesting thing. So in the next century, after the English Civil War, there's this thing called the Barebones Parliament, and the named after a guy in it called Praise God Barebones.
Praise God Barebones?
Praise God Barebones. But Praise God Barebones' son was called Nicholas Barebone, but his actual given name was, if Jesus Christ had not died for thee, thou'st had been damned, Barebones.
If Jesus Christ had not died for thee, thou hadst been damned, Barebones. Yeah. Please welcome to the stage, Miss. If Jesus Christ had not died for thee, that...
Can you fit that on your passport?
Oh my God! ID, driver's license, or if, like, standardized testing? You're doing the bubbles, you know? Was that all one word?
No, that's hyphenated.
Oh, great! Yeah. People complain about double-barreled last names. That's quite something.
Yeah. So anyway, he'd killed John Penry, and Whitgift actually made sure that he was the first to sign Penry's death warrant, which is what Jesus would do, I think.
I agree, yeah.
So in 1592, Parliament passed the Seditious Sectaries Act, which was specifically to crack down on the Brownites, but their sort of radical separatist message would go on to be incredibly influential. The Brownites were the precursors to those English dissenting movements I mentioned before, who've had this disproportionate influence on radical theology and politics in the following century, like the Quakers and the Muggletonians and so on. Another branch of the Brownites would then go on to found the Baptist Church, and a third segment of the Brownites, who were exhausted by all this persecution that they were facing, they left Britain for exile. And first they went to the Netherlands, but then they ended up chartering a boat called the Mayflower and setting sail to establish a new colony called Plymouth in Massachusetts.
Oh, heard of that place. That's why all of the towns in Massachusetts have the same names as towns in Devon.
Yeah.
Truro, and Exeter.
It comes immediately from Plymouth. From Whitgift's persecutions.
Wow.
So for his part in consolidating...
America is his fault.
Yeah, yeah. Well, no, you've got to take someone to blame yourself. So for his part in consolidating the dual power of the church and state, Whitgift really won the lifelong affection of the Queen. And when she died in 1603, it was him that she wanted to be by her bedside. And she forced him to kneel and pray for him the entire time. He's like in his 60s or 70s at this point. He was sort of, as he stories from being forced to kneel for hours and hours and hours and then praying just in case she died. And then when she finally went to sleep, this like old man would be like lifted to his feet and have to hobble back to Lambeth Palace.
Oh, God.
But he became very powerful and exceedingly wealthy. He was he actually used a lot of the wealth for public good, so that speaks in his favor. He established a foundation in his name that built almshouses and hospitals and schools, and the Whitgift Foundation actually still exists today. It runs three schools in Croydon, outside London, which was a place where John had a palace and he liked to stay there with the Queen. And for those people who know Croydon, the Whitgift Centre, which is the shopping mall in the centre of town, is actually built on land that he bought and is owned by the foundation. And oh, wow. He was very flashy and also hospitable, but he often travelled with a sort of personal bodyguard of 800 horsemen when he was moving between his palaces.
800 horsemen?
Yeah, and he had his own private militia of 150 soldiers.
I think that's what Jesus would
just
have wanted.
Just like Jesus. But by this point in his life, he was very keen to hold on to power. So the Queen died without children because she'd never married. And so the bad gay king, King James VI of Scotland, who was the son of the very Catholic Mary Queen of Scots, he took the English crown as James I of England, having renounced his mother's religion. And this is exactly the sort of compromise Whitgift would have appreciated, sort of putting stability and power over reckless faith, and also retaining many of the things that made Catholicism so attractive to the elites. So in July of 1603, James was crowned by Whitgift at Westminster Abbey, using an order of service that he had devised himself, which took a pre-Reformation Catholic rite but translated it from Latin into English, which is a very Whitgiftian compromise. And in January the following year, James convened the Hampton Court Conference in an attempt to facilitate dialogue between this high church Anglicans and the Puritans, whose complaints had become deafening. So this conference led to the solidifying of many of the reforms that still structure the church today. So among the reforms was the publishing of the new translation of the Bible, known as the Authorized Version, which is one single Bible that all the churches were to have and to read and to follow. And it's a very, very influential, but also extremely beautiful work of literature, the King James Version. That's my favourite version of the Bible. But Whitgift, you know, he wasn't actually to see any of these changes, because a few weeks after the conference, he'd been suffering from jaundice and he was very weakened by these daily trips being rowed across the river to see the king in cold weather. And he suffered a stroke and he died 3 days later, having just been visited by the king, and he was 73. You're listening to Bad Gays, a podcast all about evil and complicated queer people in history. And we'd just like to take a moment to thank all our supporters over on Patreon.
Yeah, it wouldn't be possible without you. And that's why we now have for Patreon supporters and Apple Podcast subscribers, a new monthly podcast called Extra Bad Gays. And that's where we have more informal but still informed conversations about hot topics, current issues, current events, current culture. But we do it with that same analysis that makes the show. So this last month, we just talked about this new gay Fire Island nightmare community that they want to build in the Mediterranean. But it ended up becoming a much deeper conversation about the history of gentrification, about gay men's complicity in it, about how it affects queer communities. And that's the kind of analysis you can expect from the show, along with, episodes about Diva Down George Santos and our favorite and least favorite gay Christmas movies.
And if you still feel like you haven't had your fill of bad gays, why not check out our book, which is available now, Bad Gays, A Homosexual History, in hardback or paperback. And it's also now available in Italian translation and coming soon in Thai and in Spanish.
And that's at badgayspod.com/book. And our Patreon is patreon.com/badgayspod, or click subscribe in Apple Podcasts. Back to the show. Well, thanks you for that story, and also for the trip through the English Reformation that you took us on.
A whistle stop tour.
I wanted to ask about kind of changes at this time in attitudes about same-sex desire, right? And how, like, did Wycliffe, other than having these kind of rumors about him or kind of scurrilous gossip be published in these reformist pamphlets, like, is there any record of Wycliffe making any particular engagement with sodomy as a topic? Like, did he leave behind a track record of pushing canon law in one direction or the other, or was he just sort of standing silently by at a time when the Reformation is making this more of a personal and less of a clerical thing, and therefore kind of sharpening the penalties for folks?
Well, it's out of his hands, because the whole point about the English Reformation is the shift of so many laws from canon law to secular law. So the same-sex activity is not something today or then policed by the Church of England. It's policed by the state. Whereas other stuff like same-sex marriage, because that's to do with the sacrament and therefore is a church matter, those things are policed by the Archbishop of Canterbury, which is why at the moment they're in this awful pickle, because obviously the Anglican Church in England in general tends to want to reform towards some sort of acknowledgement of same-sex marriage, and in the United States, but there are also sort of pressures thinking that it might split the communion, because other churches, Anglican churches across the world, or the Anglican communions, don't want to agree to same-sex marriage. And it has to all held together under one Anglican communion still. Again, it's this power brokering thing. But Wycliffe himself, as far as I'm aware, didn't really have anything to do with it, because at that point it had already moved out of his remit.
Right, yeah, that makes sense. I just wasn't sure if there was any, something had come up or if there was any.
No, but it is telling that for the last, I think, 5 or 10 years of his life, he did move his friend, Dr. Pern, into his house in Lambeth Palace and took care of him there.
It is telling, yeah. Like you did with all your tutors at university, right? The ones who are all living here.
Yeah.
I also wanted to ask about this sort of seemingly shameless degree to which some of these people, including Pern, but also Wycliffe, were able to kind of go back and forth between the different sides of these factions. On the one hand, I mean, we've been joking throughout the whole episode, well, it's a smart thing to do, right? Like, you sort of go with whatever the tide is, but like, at a certain point, isn't it actually kind of dangerous? Because, is it ever commented on outside of these kind of radical publications of, like, these people are sort of moving like weather vanes? Or is it just that everyone is so eager to have people follow them and to do what they say that just by kind of going with the predominant spirit of the time, you can kind of always keep the loyalty of the people above you in the hierarchy?
Well, I think the thing to think about actually is, in a time when, there wasn't a lot of, there wasn't a lot of publishing, and there's nothing like, of course, like Twitter today, how do you know what someone else believes in a way that you can nail down? Like, the only way you know what people
believe... Well, if they say it preach it from a church pulpit.
If you preach it from a church pulpit, but you have to remember that all this stuff was happening. Like until the Brownists, these people weren't splitting from the church. The Puritans, there was the Church of England and there was the Catholic Church, but these debates were almost all happening within the Church of England. And these were different factions within the Church of England. But if you turned up to your, as a normal person, if you turned up to church on a Sunday and read from the Book of Common Prayer, then you're safe. It's only, you have to actually be quite bold in preaching against what's happening for you to be noticed by the authorities. So he could just be turning up at his church and giving his sermon on charity and et cetera, and not having a sort of explicit debate about the direction that he thinks the liturgy should go in, or the way that whether there should be bishops or not. And so if you keep your head down, and largely he kept his head down during Mary's reign, he could survive within that context. You know, there were plenty of people, right, within Mary's reign who were Church of England bishops who just were reamalgamated back into the Catholic Church. And then when Elizabeth came in, they were split again from the church.
You mentioned, Hugh, that by the end of the Reformation, people are able to, you know, probably uncomfortably and with a lot of repression, but at least legally and without being put to death, you know, be Catholic in Protestant countries, be Protestant in Catholic countries. So at what point is the Catholic Church allowed back into England as something that can exist as a kind of minority religion alongside the Church of England?
So it's a complicated question because by the end of the Elizabethan period, almost, there is a move towards, I guess, more toleration of Catholicism because it becomes less of a threat, the immediate threat of it. And so under James I, there is a degree of toleration for Catholic worship, although that is then again suppressed after the Gunpowder Plot, because it seems a Catholic plot to put Catholic back on the throne and things like this. And then, of course, under the Stuarts, under Charles I, there's a very strong sense that maybe the king is a crypto-Catholic and the Puritans gain more power in Parliament and so on and so forth. But that repression that was happening under Elizabeth and Mary, it never returns in the same way. But the real big change comes with what's called the Glorious Revolution in 1688, which is when the son of Charles II, so there's been the English Revolution, the Commonwealth, there's a period without a king at all, and then Charles II, the son, comes back, and his son James is then deposed by the introduction of a firmly Protestant family with William and Mary, and after that, really in the sort of 18th century, Catholic life has sort of dissipated so much within Europe, within England. There's no Catholic aristocracy as such. Catholics have very little power, that it ceases to become such a threat. So there's more opportunities for people to worship. But it's not until the middle of the 19th century, the Victorian era, where Catholic emancipation starts to happen. And again, it's a complicated subject because there's differences between Ireland, where there is a huge Catholic population of colonized peoples, and in England. But yeah, that's a period when the laws that stop Catholics holding office, for example, come into place. But it's not until, I think, 2017 when they changed the law that says that an heir to the throne can't marry a Catholic.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's 2017.
But that's also because, again, this is not a theological dispute, right? This is about the crown.
This is about the crown, yeah. Because the head of state, the monarch, is also the head of the Church of England. And so to today, if you were the heir to the throne and you were to convert to Catholicism yourself, you wouldn't be allowed to take the throne.
Right, yeah, it's definitional. Throne, they're the head of the crown is the Church of England. So, we come to the end. It's time to decide good, bad, gay, not. What do we think?
I think it's likely that there's some sort of romantic style relationships going on from the evidence and the sort of the fact that people seem to think that at the time.
Not at Cambridge.
Yeah, at Cambridge. You know, the fact that obviously, I mean, Bacon's brother was definitely gay. Bacon was almost certainly having some sort of same-sex activity. You know, things were different back then. James I and VI was having
gay
all over the place.
Gay spies at Cambridge? No.
but... I'd say probably gay. And yes, bad. I mean, like, he's having people executed and sign their death warrants. But at the same time, an interesting...
Just like Jesus would have wanted.
Just like Jesus would have wanted. But at the same time, he's an interesting figure in a way that he sort of managed to navigate the English Reformation and essentially helped put a cap on it and end it.
Right. And sort of moderating and mediating. And I don't know. I think it's easy to make fun of figures like this. And it's easy to praise people who have, stand for beliefs. And I think also in a situation like the English Reformation, where the entire thing is about a kind of elite dispute or inter-elite dispute, and people are being killed for it, maybe there actually is, in a weird way, something admirable about, you know, keeping your head down and trying to get as few people's head chopped off as possible. But then, of course, he ends up chopping off a lot of heads.
I'm with the idealists on this, personally. I'm the zealots and the true believers, but that's just me.
Yeah. Well, and I'm with the Anna Bolena and Maria Stuarda. So if people want to find out more about John Whitgift or the English Reformation, where should they turn? What are some of the sources that you use to do the episode?
If you want to know more about Whitgift, I was reading a book called The Archbishops of Canterbury by P.G. Maxwell Stewart, which is goes through all of them a fair pace. And in much more depth, there is a very good essay called John Whitgift's History, which is on the website of the Whitgift Foundation, who are still doing his good works down in Croydon. And if you're interested in the Reformation more generally, there is a fantastic book which sort of covers the entire thing start to finish called Reformation, Europe's House Divided by Dermot McGulloch, which is like the big chief book on it.
And I'll throw in even a challenge to our listeners. I suspect that some of you may live in or near Croydon. And if you send us a picture of yourself either holding our book or listening to our show at the Whitgift Center, we will repost it on our social media. I'm Ben Miller. I am on the internet at Ben Writes Things, benwritesthings.com.
I'm Hugh Lemmy. You can find me online on my newsletter, hugh.substack.com.
And until next week, bye.
Bye.
Bad. Bad, 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 bad